I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of December. Mondays at 1, all things political. The over the weekend Des Moines Register poll shows Ted Cruz is now leading in Iowa. We'll take a closer look at his ideas for governing. Chuck Todd writes about the profound effect a Donald Trump nomination would have on the composition and philosophy of the Republican Party. There are two presidential debates this week. Tomorrow, the Republicans. On Saturday, the Democrats. This morning, President Obama issued a statement at the Pentagon on ISIS strategy. And the female assassin in San Bernardino passed three background checks by American immigration officials as she moved to the U.S. from Pakistan. On social media, she had expressed her support of violent jihad and said that she wanted to be a part of it. Immigration authorities didn't find those posts. On Saturday, 195 nations agreed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. President Obama said this is the best chance to save the planet that we've got. And today marks 3 years since the Newtown shootings. Our guest this hour is John McCormack. He's senior writer at the Weekly Standard. He is from Wisconsin and has been on our show several times before. We'll be welcoming phone calls for John, and here is how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. John, hi. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, where are you from in Wisconsin again?
It's Baldwin, Wisconsin, in St. Croix County.
Okay. Always nice to have a Wisconsin guy on the show. Well, let's start with Ted Cruz. Several polls, Des Moines Register among them, showing over the weekend Ted Cruz is now leading in Iowa. What's that all about?
Well, you know, the Des Moines Register poll is a really important poll because it's really hard to tell who actually are, you know, the people who are going to show up and vote in these caucuses. And so you get a lot of polls that will just ask people, are you Republican? And then the polls will show Trump doing really well. Well, the Des Moines Register poll is done by this woman who has a really great track record, and she supposedly and has a track record of really showing who's going to show up to these caucuses. And Cruz is up big, you know, double digits against Trump in Iowa. And, you know, Ted Cruz, he just sort of fits the profile of the state. He is staunchly conservative, the state's caucus goers, you know, staunchly conservative, a religious conservative, an evangelical, a social conservative. And so someone like Trump, who is really less conservative and not religious, he doesn't really fit the profile of Iowa. And a lot of people have been expecting Cruz to make his move eventually. Seems like it's happening right now, and that he is really, you know, kind of sitting pretty in the state of Iowa to win this first contest.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about him more in just a moment. You retweeted a piece that Chuck Todd wrote, I guess, over the weekend, which I found interesting. The effect that a Trump nomination could have on the composition and philosophy of the Republican Party. He wrote that it could be profound. Would you agree? And if so, what would it be?
Well, I think so. Is that piece it's by Matthew Continetti in the Washington Free Beacon, a good friend of mine. And he writes about how, you know, Trump, he's really tapping into a different set of issues. You know, it's really not conservatism as it has been understood under Ronald Reagan or even George W. Bush. It's a much more populist conservative, much more like Ross Perot. You know, again, like I said, some of these voters would tend to be more secular, more liberal. You might call them the angry middle, angry moderates, who are upset about issues like immigration and trade, issues where the elites of both the Republican and the Democratic Party have had a sort of a general consensus, trade is good, more immigration is good, and Trump is sort of tapping into these issues and saying, hey, no, we need to really rethink these things, do it a completely different way, being very aggressive, you know, politically incorrect, speaking his mind. So, yeah, I think you could see the party sort of end up shifting in shape in all sorts of different ways if, you know, Trump really gains traction, even if he doesn't win the nomination, if he simply performs well, if he ends up winning a few states or a handful of states or coming in second in a bunch of contests. I think that you're going to see the party trying to appeal to that constituency more in the years to come.
Mm. He also went on to write that Trump's nationalism has far more in common with the conservatism of Marine Le Pen, leader of France's National Front, than with the conservatism of Ronald Reagan. When it came down to it, that party didn't do all that well in France.
It didn't. So that's the question. You know, right now, not a single vote has been cast in the Republican primary, where all of this talk is based upon, you know, the supposition that the polls are actually right and they're going to be in some way predictive. You know, we've had multiple polling failures in this industry in the past couple of years. In 2014, didn't see a lot of those races coming. We just had a Kentucky governor's race where they thought the Republican was going to lose by, you know, 5 points. He ends up winning by nearly 10. You know, so for all this talk about Donald Trump being this dominant front runner, you know, when he's even at 30%, well, you know, he may very well be at 18%, or maybe he's at 40%, in which case he really is a front runner. But again, this is all based on, you know, speculation that the polls are correct. But, you know, he's definitely got getting a lot of attention on the ground. He's really gotten, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars worth of free or earned media, depending on how you like to talk to it, like to describe it, just for being such a showman and being able to get all these cameras in front of his face and cover every single thing that he does.
Yeah, they sure do. And then some. What do you think about Marco Rubio? I always thought he was going to be the guy, and it appeared a little while ago that he was rising fairly substantially in the polls. It would seem to me as though he might be able to attract more of the voters the Republicans have said they need to attract in order to win the presidency.
Well, I had always thought he had a really good shot, too, because, you know, he's the most naturally talented politician. He's the most likable or charismatic. He is also in the center of the party right now. I mean, the Republican Party has moved in a conservative direction. And so while Marco Rubio may have been, you know, listed as a staunch conservative, a Tea Party conservative 5 years ago, I think right now he really is sort of the center of gravity in the Republican Party. He also, his sort of profile, young, fresh-faced, conservative, sort of mirrors a lot of the success stories he had out of 2014. In these Senate races. But, you know, ultimately he has to win, you know, one of these early primaries. I think that the whole month of February you're going to have four contests: Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. And Rubio's, you know, he's really got to either come in, you know, second in a bunch of them, or he's got to win one of those to make it to the final round, which I would say begins really in March. So we're going to see lots and lots of delegates apportioned. So I don't know, you know, where does he make his break? Can he really? I don't know right now. It's such a fluid process with such a divided field, and so many Republicans don't have their minds made up. I don't see it, but I would say at normal times, you know, someone like with Rubio's profile, he does seem to be the strongest general election candidate. There was just a new poll out today showing that Donald Trump loses to Hillary Clinton by 3 points. Donald Trump loses by 10 points. Ted Cruz loses to Hillary Clinton by 3 points, and Rubio is actually ahead by 3 points.
So. Really?
Yeah, so it's really unusual for a party, I mean, to, you know, the idea that, I mean, with Trump's numbers, that's just simply suicidal, and that's why I don't think that at the end of the day, you know, Republicans want somebody who at least has a shot. And Cruz and Rubio, you know, up three, down three, it's still early.
Right.
I don't think those early polls are going to determine a lot of votes, but as things get closer, if Rubio's ahead and the other candidates are behind, I think that's going to bring a lot of votes to him, as people actually have to go into the voting booth and select a candidate.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite?
Not really. I would say that, you know, we try and be, you know, we're conservative at the Weekly Standard, and we have our own opinions, so we try and treat everyone fairly. I would say candidates like, you know, someone like Marco Rubio probably fits my personal, you know, philosophy a little more closely and temperamentally than, you know, someone like Ted Cruz. But, yeah, we don't really advocate particular candidates or opine on them. We try and report and analyze where they stand on the issues and how the race is going.
And how do you explain, when you talk about conservatism and extreme conservatism, which seems to be exemplified by Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, how do you explain the attraction of that philosophy among many Republican primary voters this year?
Well, I think at the heart of, you know, what really separated Ted Cruz and the rest of the conservatives isn't so much the issues as it was his tactical approach. You know, we're going to have a government shutdown to blow up Obamacare. And actually, Marco Rubio even kind of signed on to that, but he was just a lot more quiet about the issue than Ted Cruz was. But yeah, I think people of both parties are just, you know, were frustrated with, you know, the gridlock in Washington. And, you know, the whole idea of Trump's, you know, Cruz's hashtag make DC listen, just the power of, with our willpower and our courage, we can stand up to these people and steamroll them. And you kind of seen that go off into a new and, I would say, you know, troubling direction with Trump and sort of, you know, this raw power of the executive that Trump sort of believes in, that he can just, you know, mandate that there's a death penalty in sorts of cases and sort of trampling on the idea of federalism, or, you know, this idea that we would have, you know, a database of people based on their religion, which is, you know, pretty spooky. I would not call that conservatism. And so, You know, that's really kind of where this is going. People are frustrated that nothing is getting done, and, you know, they look to somebody, a bold, you know, tough-talking guy who says he can actually stand up to, you know, the special interests in Washington and get things done. I think ultimately people are frustrated with the fact that we have divided government. And in our system, when, you know, when Congress thinks one thing and the president thinks another thing, not a whole lot happens. Gridlock is exactly how the system is supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
In times like this, on big issues where there's a big divide.
Mm-hmm. Debates tomorrow night. Who's out tomorrow?
Who's out tomorrow? You mean who's not in the main debate?
Yeah.
Just the Lindsey Graham, Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee. I think just over the weekend, Rand Paul and Chris Christie were both added back in. So it should be a pretty big stage tomorrow night. Again, that's been part of the problem for these candidates, other than Trump, this is really their one shot to get national attention. And they're sharing the stage, though, with 10 other candidates or so. So, you know, some big questions going into tomorrow night are whether, you know, does Trump actually go after Cruz? Cruz has gone out of his way to be friendly to Trump. He's even said privately that, you know, he thinks Trump doesn't have the judgment to be the commander-in-chief with his finger on the button. But in public, he likes to smother him with love and give him a bear hug so that he can ultimately inherit Trump's voters. And so now that Trump's actually losing in Iowa, I think he needs to make a move against Cruz eventually if he wants to, you know, if he wants to win that first state.
Yeah. Do you think it's weird that the Democrats have so many fewer debates and they're debating on Saturday night?
I do, and I think that has to be intentional because, you know, the Democratic National Committee is smart enough to know that people are not watching the debates. I think the last debate got fewer viewers on Saturday night on a major network on CBS, and the Republican debate on Fox Business Channel, which isn't even in a lot of households, got on a Thursday night. So I think this is just pure speculation, but I would think the idea behind it is that, you know, they want to protect Hillary Clinton. The more debate she has to go to, you know, the more people might end up leaving her. Also, you don't want voters to get bored with her too early. But there has been some dissent within the Democratic Party. Tulsi Gabbard, a congresswoman from Hawaii, has been sharply critical of the Democratic National Committee for hosting such a small number of debates. I think that the next one might be during a playoff football game, NFL game. So I think that, yeah, this is a deliberate strategy to minimize the importance of the Democratic debates.
And polls at this point are showing that Hillary is doing very well in Iowa. Do you think that there could be, as some have suggested, an upsurge in support, people going to the polls for Bernie Sanders that could change this dynamic?
There could be. You know, Iowa's always been a late-breaking state, and it's the real party activists who end up showing up to vote. So I could definitely see, you know, Bernie Sanders doing well there. He's obviously doing very well in New Hampshire, the neighboring state to Vermont. I mean, the theory, I think that, you know, the Democratic Party would sort of panic if Hillary Clinton lost the first two contests. But I think ultimately, and I think there's a lot to this, that South Carolina, she's up by something like, you know, 30, 40, 50 points.
Ooh.
And that, you know, even if she loses those first two contests, she comes back in South Carolina. And really, there's no real consensus candidate who could really end up bringing the whole party together other than Hillary Clinton. I think that Sanders is probably too liberal, too conservative, too much of a democratic socialist, to use his own, how he describes himself, to win the nomination. But then again, we've seen some trends in politics lately where parties are really going to the extremes. You know, in Great Britain, we've seen Jeremy Corbyn, a very left-wing guy, you know, end up taking over Labour. And like you said, we've seen some real right-wing movements gaining traction in other European countries as well.
Oh, it's also strange, isn't it? It's a really strange presidential year.
It's a strange time to be alive, and I think that a lot of people are wondering exactly, you know, what is pushing it, what are the underlying factors here? And, you know, on one hand, the economy, it looks like it's doing pretty well. You know, you've got the stock market's been up, unemployment is down, but you have a lot of people who've simply given up on work. You've also got middle-class wage stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that could have a lot to do with sort of this this discontent. Also, I mean, in foreign policy, you know, we've seen ISIS, this Al-Qaeda offshoot, you know, it's got a terrorist army with a foreign external operations apparatus out there that's now launching attacks against the West. And just the idea that we can't, you know, I mean, Trump, not that he's presented any real ideas to solve any of these problems, but he's, you know, he's venting that frustration that we don't win anymore, that we're getting beaten in all these sort of different respects.
Mm. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the president's comments at the Pentagon late this morning, and we'll also look at, this is an interesting story the New York Times had yesterday, maybe you saw it, the female assassin who carried out the attacks in San Bernardino with her husband had passed three background checks by American immigration officials as she came to the U.S. from Pakistan, and she had posted on social media her views on violent jihad, saying that she supported it and she also wanted to be a part of it. So I guess it would be pretty hard to go through all the comments of everybody who wants to get in the country on social media, but would you have thought this would have been done as a matter of course? Does it now seem that this needs to be done as a matter of course? We welcome your phone calls for all things political. Move us in other directions as well. If you would like, John McCormack is our guest, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, a conservative magazine and blog. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, all things political. We go now to phone calls for John McCormack. Our number, 800-486-8655. Starting our calls with Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Yes, so good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a question and just a quick comment. That is, the question is for your guest, who seems to be a rather moderate and intelligent conservative who really is very rational, at least according to what he's said prior to taking phone calls. And my question is this, that I was wondering why the Republican nominees for Republican candidates for president are not confronted with the fact that they blame government and their supporters blame government for all of the problems that we have. However, these men and in some cases women are the government, and yet they've never been confronted with the fact that they are the government and that members of their group or organization or their peers have done things such as try to shut down or actually shut down the government, have made statements such as we want to make the president's first term his only term. These kinds of statements and actions are made by government officials. They are the government. And then why is it that he or others in the media, and yourself included, Kathleen, do not confront these people with these things, you know, that they are the government? Why is it that the media doesn't ask questions like this?
John.
Well, I think, you know, the broader critique about Republicans being anti-government, that's certainly a long-standing fair critique from liberals and Democrats. And I think that, you know, most conservatives will respond that, you know, they're really not trying to end government. They're trying to make it better. They're trying to, I mean, even an issue like Social Security or Medicare, you know, you won't find a Republican today who wants to get rid of those things. I mean, they want to make it in a more sustainable direction. They want to put power in the direction of the individual rather than, you know, single-payer health care or something like that, Canadian-style health care. You know, they've got their own plans for how they want to, you know, direct money and subsidies and reduce the number of regulations that you'd have, for example, in the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, you would strip all those mandates back and let people have greater selection and variety and choice in terms of what they buy. You know, in terms of Medicare, what Republicans want to do is not to get rid of it, but for people who are my age, 55 and under, you know, we're on track to having this whole thing go bankrupt. So what they're proposing to do is just to have more choice where people can get a certain stipend that would cover the second least expensive plan, and if you take the least expensive plan, you get to pocket the difference. You can pay for a more expensive plan. It would still have all these certain mandates about what level of coverage it has, but it's all the sort of, you know, we sometimes over-exaggerate the difference about the size of government. You know, I mean, it's true, I'm a staunch conservative. You know, if I had been around 50 years ago, would I have opposed Medicare? I don't know, but it's here, and so the question is what we do with it now that it's here, and I don't know of a single Republican running for office who, you know, actually wants to abolish these big government programs, but they just want to put it in a more of a conservative, small government, you know, individual-focused direction.
Thanks, Reed, for your call. Matt in Fitchburg. Hi.
Good afternoon. So it's clear that Trump and even Cruz are not the chosen candidates for the so-called establishment. And my question for the guest is, how is the establishment going to beat Trump and then get stuck with Cruz, I guess, if that's sort of where we are right now?
I don't know. I think that this is just it's an interesting primary. I don't really know how this thing's going to shake out at all. I think we could very easily see, like I said, that first month of February, you know, really being the sorting process where we'll figure out who exactly are the last 3 to 5 candidates. You've got just such a huge mess right now. They did, you know, a typical, you know, someone like me, I pay attention to politics every day. I'm guessing the listeners of this show are very politically interested and involved. But a lot of voters, they don't pay attention to the last week or two. So I think we really won't know until then how things shake out. And yeah, I would see that if Cruz wins Iowa, he definitely, you know, is going to be a contender, one of the last two or three people standing. I don't know. You know, at the end of the day, the person who becomes the nominee is the person who can get 50% of the delegates. And if Cruz and Trump and Rubio and Chris Christie, they all stick in there and they all split the delegates, you could end up going into the convention without any one candidate having a majority, and they all have to end up having a contested convention, a broker convention, where you know, they do wheeling and dealing and lobbying and jockeying behind the scenes to try and get to that magic 50%.
Where is Trump nationally now, John? What are his numbers?
You know, I haven't looked closely, but usually in the high 20s. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, I mean, you know, with the field this spread out, if you can consolidate, if any one candidate can dominate the news coverage as much and fire enough of the party up to be the front runner. I mean, Rudy Giuliani was the quote unquote front runner, you know, in the 20s. You know, Herman Cain was winning the Republican primary at one point because the party was uncertain or it was really wide open. You know, I would say, I mean, I said this when Jeb Bush was the quote-unquote front-runner at 22%. You know, when the candidate's at that low, I don't think they're a real front-runner, you know, a genuine, formidable front-runner. That was somebody like George W. Bush in 2000. He was at, like, you know, 60, 70% in the polls. Somewhere like Hillary Clinton is now today in her race against Bernie Sanders. I mean, Bernie Sanders gets a much bigger chunk of the Democratic Party than Trump is even getting right now. But the Republican Party, just, you slice the pie 10, 12 different ways, and you can be the number one guy with getting a much, you know, a not terribly huge chunk of the party.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about terrorism. It's been a horrendous time in this country and in France and other places in the world. There was a New York Times story, front page yesterday, that the female assassin in San Bernardino had passed 3 background checks by American immigration officials as she moved to the U.S. from Pakistan, but she had talked on social media, I'm not sure what kind of social media, but she had talked about her admiration for violent jihad and her desire to be a part of it. Evidently, immigration officials do not review social media. That would be a huge thing to have to do, should they?
I think they're going to have to. I mean, there were a lot of red flags that were missed. Apparently, she had attended a very radical institute that preaches a quote-unquote strict literalist interpretation of the Quran. The New York Times indicated that they didn't preach violent jihad, but I find that it's kind of hard to square those two statements, where if they preach a literalist version, you know, you would take literally these violent commandments in that scripture. Obviously, the vast, vast majority of Muslims do not, you know, they've contextualized or ignored or interpreted in such a way that they look to the peaceful aspects of their scripture and their religion. But someone who's been to a radical school, who had written on, I don't know whether it was Twitter or Facebook or whatever, but, you know, when the question should be, if we don't have the resources to do that sort of research, maybe we're letting too many people, and maybe we just need to reduce the amount of people who are coming in this country. We admit 1 million legal permanent residents who are going to become citizens every year. There's been some debate. I think there can be reasonable debate whether, you know, is that number too big? Should it be 500,000? Should it be 1.5 million? You know, there's different arguments, economic, national security, cultural arguments to be made about the level of immigration that we have in this country. But I definitely think that there's going to have to be some changes. There were some comments that DHS, Homeland Security officials weren't even sure if it was appropriate to be viewing these things. I think it definitely is. Mm. When you're a foreign citizen who wants the privilege to come here, you don't have, you know, constitutional free speech rights, and especially, you know, advocating the violent overthrow of the government is not something, or terrorist admiring terrorist attacks is not something that we should tolerate among anyone who wants to become a citizen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Matt, for the call. The president was at the Pentagon this morning talking about ISIL. He said that they have lost thousands of miles they once controlled, that their fighters are defecting, that we have taken out leaders, commanders, and killers one by one. We've destroyed many of their forces. He pretty much stated the same thing that he had talked about when he talked to the national address that he gave a little while ago on how we're fighting ISIS. A couple questions here. Do you think that we are making some progress here? And who of the Republican candidates do you think has a better plan? Or is everybody kind of wandering around wondering what in the world to do about them?
Well, I think there's definitely some growing debate on the Republican Party about what should be done. You know, in terms of what the president's done so far, I mean, I think there are two lines of criticism. One is that the air war that he's waged so far has been sort of half-hearted pinprick strikes. If you compare the number of missions that we've taken against ISIS and compared it to, you know, any number of other campaigns, whether Kosovo or the first Iraq war, it just, you know, the number that we're doing now just pales in comparison to the number that we were doing in these other campaigns. We've also had rules of engagement, which are, you know, I'm someone who believes in just war theory and that we should be ethical in our military missions. But really, this administration has taken it to new levels that are really beyond any level of what's necessary, or and making it ineffective. You know, not even bombing these oil trucks because they were worried that they were civilian drivers. I mean, it's unfortunate as collateral damages. You know, in war, when you have a legitimate target, it's okay to take it out. And I don't think the president is waging an air war as effective as he should be. The second question then is, can we ever win this battle without ground troops on the ground? And I think every Republican candidate agrees. You know, ideally, you want to have local Arab ground troops, Sunni ground troops, who can take the fight to ISIS. Obviously, they've failed so far. So the question is, I mean, for our own security, do we want a certain number of American forces down there to take out ISIS before this terrorist army of, you know, 40 or 50,000 grows into a terrorist army of 100,000, and they have a launching pad for terrorist attacks, not only in Paris, but in, you know, Washington, D.C., in New York, in Chicago, in L.A., and many more San Bernardinos. So, you know, that's a legitimate debate. I mean, obviously, a lot of people do not want to get embroiled in another war in the Middle East. At the same time, the idea of letting, you know, a brutal al-Qaeda offshoot to control its own country and have its, you know, terrorist training grounds, that's unacceptable to a lot of people as well. So I think you'll see some debate on the Republican Party about whether we should put ground troops in or not. I think most of them are coming in that direction. Ted Cruz recently opposed it. Now he said he's open to it after we've, you know, really had a real, you know, air campaign as much as we can do. Then we'll reevaluate at that point and see if we need to put ground troops in there.
I can't imagine, though, the American people would be too enthusiastic about that, would they?
No, I mean, definitely not. But I think that just the facts on the ground are pushing people in that direction. I don't have any of the polls, the precise numbers, but I do know that a couple of recent polls have actually shown majority support. I think one was a CNN poll for some of the U.S. ground forces in there to take the fight to ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Let's also talk about guns for a moment. Today is the third anniversary of Newtown. There have been some moving statements from some of the parents who lost their children, of course, today, 3 years ago today. What about this? Gosh, it is such a contentious issue. What about trying to keep those kinds of events and all of the deaths that happen due to gun violence in this country down? It's not something that we seem to be able to do anything about. Can we do anything? Have any of the Republican presidential candidates come up with a good plan, John?
You know, honestly, I don't think that anybody has come up with a good plan. All the proposals, you know, I think the Washington Post fact checker even pointed this out, that, you know, Marco Rubio said none of the proposed, gun control efforts, the so-called gun show loophole, they wouldn't have actually stopped any of these attacks. And so I don't know what could be done, honestly. I think the problem here with most of these attacks, not the terrorist attack, but they're loners. Some of them may be mentally ill. And, it's the idea that these people who are sort of on the margins of society and the fringes, who are completely by themselves, are going out there and getting a gun, But if they were in a community, I can't imagine anyone, if they knew this guy, they'd sell him a gun. So, I almost wonder if, could you end up with some system whereby, you had to have three people say, to the best of my knowledge, this person isn't a risk to himself or others. And, I don't know. I just don't know what the way that there is to stop this. I think that it's a real tragedy. I haven't really seen any plans to stop these mass attacks, which are really unsettling. The good news is, though, that, in terms of the overall number of murders, which don't take place in these mass attack situations, the murder level in this country is down sharply from the early 90s. So there has been some progress on that. Obviously, gun control hasn't been responsible for that, since we've been going in the other direction to having less gun control in this country for the last 20 years.
Do you think that we will have a national discussion on the kinds of guns that you can buy in this country? Should we?
I think you certainly can. From my reading, that it seems like the assault weapons ban, which was something introduced in the Senate, there's really been no stomach for that, even among Democrats. Harry Reid, following the Newtown shooting, he decided to shelve that because he thought it couldn't even get 35 or 40 votes in the Senate. You need 60 to pass something. The assault weapons ban, it really, the distinctions that it makes relies on a lot of technical things that aren't really going to make these guns less lethal. At the end of the day, a semi-automatic weapon is simply a gun that you pull the trigger and it fires one bullet. That's a standard handgun. It's unconstitutional to just ban a standard handgun, as the courts have held, and I think that's probably correct. And so standard handguns, standard rifles, it's a lot of these, bells and whistles that don't necessarily make the gun much more lethal. They look a lot scarier, with the scope and the pistol grip and all sorts of different things like that. But at the end of the day, the shooting in Charleston, just a normal handgun, the shooting in Oregon, I believe, was just a normal handgun as well. And so I don't think you've had any Democrats really come out for a total, repeal the Second Amendment, ban handguns platform.
Mm-hmm. We welcome more phone calls. John McCormick is our guest this hour. It's all things political. We're talking, we started with Ted Cruz, now appearing to be doing very well, at least at the moment, in Iowa, and that straw poll, the caucuses, rather, are going to be taking place 1st of February, so it's not all that far from here to there. Is that an indication that Donald Trump is just becoming too out there for many Republican primary voters, and they are extremely conservative? Ted Cruz, of course, a staunch conservative, that they find that he's just a little less out there than Donald Trump is and has some of the same platform. We're looking at the debate that will take place tomorrow. We're looking at the president's comments this morning on progress we may be making in fighting, he calls it, ISIL. We're looking at the Democrats a little bit, although we have more of a Republican perspective because John is a senior writer for the Weekly Standard, which is a conservative weekly magazine and blog. And whatever else you'd like to bring up, we'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. Do the Republicans have a problem? Maybe this Ted Cruz thing or Marco Rubio will play out and they may become the nominee, but would the effect his nomination would have on the philosophy and the composition of the Republican Party be profound and not very good? Do the Republicans find themselves in a quandary as to what to do with him? All right, more phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'd like to thank all of you who contributed during last week's year-end membership drive. We had more than 2,100 listeners pledge, including nearly 500 sustaining members, and we are pleased to welcome 450 new members to WPR. You donated more than $296,000 to fund the Wisconsin Public Radio programs that are so important to you and to your families and your community, and we really want to thank you so very much, very much. John McCormick is our guest. It's All Things Political you're listening to for this Monday, the 14th of December, and we're welcoming your phone calls. And let's go to Bob in Waukesha, our next caller for you, John. Hi, Bob.
Hello, and thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome.
I'd like to ask your guest if he could answer as to just a general figure, not perfectly accurate, what percentage of the conservative congressional members who would vote for having boots on the ground fighting ISIL, what percentage of those people have a son or a daughter who actually would be in those boots on the ground in Syria, not just sitting, you know, at a beautiful Air Force base in Colorado Springs, but actually in the boots on the ground? And I understand that we could also ask this of any Democratic leaders or liberal people, but I'm just curious.
Okay, John.
Well, I don't know the exact number, and I know that there are, in terms of people who have actually served, that there are a number of new veterans who served. Tom Cotton, a Republican of Arkansas, he was in the Army Rangers. He served in Afghanistan and Iraq. Joni Ernst, she was in the Iowa National Guard. She was doing convoy work in Iraq during the war. They have these arguments. I think that, if the argument is that people are hypocritical, that's a fair argument. We can talk about people's character and whether they're cowardly or not, but I think that people on both sides of this argument, if the argument is that civilians or people who don't have children in the military don't get to have an opinion, and that the only people whose opinion about whether we go to war or not should be left up to combat veterans, I'd be willing to accept that. I think that the vast majority of veterans have a much more sort of serious view about the threat that that ISIS poses, and that they're willing to go. They're gung-ho. My friends who served in combat, who were shot at and stuff, they are, they think that, many of them think that we need to go back in and do this. I'm sure that there are a good number of people who think that we should stay out completely and that we shouldn't. And that's a legitimate debate we can have. If you want to call, different people cowardly for not having fought themselves, that's, it's fine to make character attacks. But I think at the end of the day that we're all citizens in a democratic republic, and that we need to, look at what's best for our country and make the argument one way or the other.
Mm. Thanks, Bob, very much for the call. Ricardo in Racine. Hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering, Congress is the majority of Republicans, the House and Senate, and of course Obama is a Democrat. The Congress ratings keep going down, and Obama's ratings keep going up, and they seem to be against everything that he tries. He's always wrong. Why don't they start talking about working with the president? I think we elect people to work together. Why is this always happening?
John?
I think that I would think that's a problem with both sides. When George W. Bush was the president and Democrats took back over the Congress back in 2007, 2008, I don't remember a whole lot of talk about how much the Democrats wanted to work with President George W. Bush. They kind of got through what little things they could, and they kept the government funded. But there's a real and honest debate in this country about, the direction that we should go in. And until, the parties align one way or the other, we're probably not going to get a lot of progress. There has been some movement on stuff like, a trade in the Pacific with Pacific countries. There's been talk about tax reform, but again, there's a big divide there where the president wants $100 trillion in new tax revenue, and Republicans don't want any new tax revenue to come out of it, just to sort of close some loopholes and lower the rates with that revenue. But yeah, that's where we sit right now. And you know, and until the American people can make up their mind one way or the other, if they want to, you know, they want do they continue to want to divide a government, or they want to give Democrats complete control or Republicans complete control. And until they give one party or the other complete control, we're going to have this gridlock.
What did you think of the climate change agreement, 195 nations agreeing to reduce emissions, the president saying this is the best chance to save the planet that we've got?
I'll have to tell you the truth. I did not follow it closely over the weekend. One of the big criticisms I have seen in just reading the newspaper this morning is the idea that there's no real enforcement mechanism. You know, when they banned CFCs by treaty, that was a requirement. You know, there were penalties involved. Now it's more of just sort of a gentleman's agreement. And so I think that's probably the biggest mark against this one. Again, I haven't really taken a close look at this, so I'll have to pass on this one.
Okay. Ricardo, thanks. Willem in Colfax. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to address the Second Amendment, which to me, in my understanding of the English language, is that the first sentence of the Second Amendment qualifies the second sentence. And so it's about establishing and having a well-regulated militia, which the founders thought was important because they didn't have a standing army, and an armed citizenry would be more difficult, you know, from an invading force or something like that. And in David McCullough's book about 1776, George Washington, in a letter to the Congress, suggests that we need a well-regulated army. So that term, well-regulated, was a term of the times. And I think that I don't see where we're, you know, allowing people to have military-style weapons with a 30-round clip has anything to do with hunting. No one's ever suggested people hunting rifles would be taken, but countries like Australia, where they banned these kind of weapons, actually collected them and destroyed them, their murder rates have dropped dramatically. And I don't understand why in this country we can't see that this is a problem, that people can get these kind of weapons. And then the Republican response seems to be, well, let's arm everyone. So some guy that's running in the park to pick up his child because he's late for work, someone else might draw down on him and think, well, he's abducting a child and I'm, you know, the good guy, so I'm going to put them down. I mean, I think it's you know, the Second Amendment is clear. It's about a militia. It's not about arming everyone to the teeth.
Do you think, John, we'll have a debate about the meaning of the Second Amendment at some point in the near future?
You know, I don't know. I think that, you know, Democrats just haven't had any willpower to go after that. You know, when the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate with overwhelming majorities, filibuster-proof majority in the Senate and the White House for 2 years, they controlled it. And how many gun control votes were held by Speaker Pelosi or Leader Reid when they actually could have sent a bill to President Obama and get it signed into law? Zero. They held zero votes on gun control when they actually had the power to pass something. So, I think that Democrats, they want to make that argument that they should. Or, I mean, right now they've got a majority on the Supreme Court that disagrees with your caller's interpretation of the Second Amendment, that believes there is an individual right. I don't think that anyone in the Supreme Court would say that, you know, we can pass things in the margin. I really wouldn't care personally. I wouldn't care too much if they said that, you know, a clip can have 12 rounds instead of 30 rounds. But let's just be realistic here, that that's not going to stop anything. It takes 2 seconds to empty a clip and put a new one in there. So, you know, would some of these massacres, would 16 people die instead of 17? Maybe. You know, maybe it's worth considering those things. But I just don't think that you're really going to be serious. I think that if you the real problem is, too, I mean, this country, you know, there's tens of millions of guns in circulation right now. Like I said, normal standard handguns, the kind of stuff that they got rid of in Australia. I mean, if we think it's ridiculous that we're going to deport 11 million people here, but it's somehow practical that we're going to confiscate, you know, what, 40, 50, however many millions of guns, tens of millions of guns we've got in this country, I think that's just impractical. And so I haven't really seen a real serious plan that would actually, you know, decrease these mass attacks through gun control.
There were some rumblings last week, I don't know what happened to this, that President Obama was going to take executive action on background checks. Is that within his authority?
I haven't looked exactly what he's done, but I don't think so. I mean, almost all, you know, to have a valid executive authority, you have to, it has to be based on some sort of law. It has to be rooted in a law actually passed by Congress and signed by a president. It's an interpretation of a law or something like that. We've seen with this president a very aggressive belief in executive power that you can sort of just ignore immigration laws and now sort of creating new gun laws. I think that, again, this, you know, this Manchin-Toomey background check bill, which has failed, I don't really think it matters much one way or the other. You know, I mean, I think if Republicans almost just went along with it to pass it, and you know, I don't think it would have much impact at all either way. I think that they're sort of avoiding the real issue here, which was what your caller said. It's about whether we should just be banning guns altogether, except with very narrow circumstances for, you know, very particular kinds of hunting rifles. You know, that's a debate that the parties just haven't been willing to have so far. Maybe we're moving in that direction.
Thanks, Willem. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. About 9/11, how could 19 Arab hijackers, 15 of which were Saudi Arabian, and Saudi Arabia was leaders, aristocracy is always a friend of the Bush family, under the Bush administration, get into that situation where they could hijack airplanes and supposedly crash them into the Twin Towers and also into the Pentagon?
Well, they did do that. John, I don't know if you want to comment that or not.
I don't know if the question is about the vetting process, like the failure that we obviously had with
CareStech.
I mean, you know, we're an open society. We allow people to come here to study, to visit, to sightsee, to do all sorts of different things. And that's part of what, you know, it's a great thing. I think that, you know, when we think about a lockdown mentality, that's something, you know, we should consider giving up, you know, our open society. I think that if we did have another 9/11, you know, one or two or three, or, you know, God forbid, something even much bigger, I do think you would sort of have sort of lockdown, Fortress America mentality really take off, you know, where we're not allowing people to come visit, or we're not allowing people to come study here unless we can know for certain that you're not a safety risk at all. Obviously they need to do a better job of searching people who are trying to immigrate here, such as this woman who clearly presented a threat, and you know, there were warning signs.
Yeah. Let's go to Dimitri in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there, John. Quick question for you, for your commentary. So one is, I recently read that there's growing support in the Republican Party for a Bernie Sanders nomination. I presume just because he's maybe an easier candidate to beat in the primary from the Republican point of view. And the second is just a pervasive lack of a socially liberal, fiscally conservative candidate on the Republican ticket. And the lack of support for someone like Kasich, who is definitely the most moderate of the candidates and just doesn't garner more than 1% of the support for whatever reason. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Dimitri.
Well, to the second point, you know, the parties have both become more ideological. The Democrats have become more liberal. The Republicans have become more conservative. So this question is, why isn't there a social liberal, fiscal conservative? I would say it's just because that's not where the party is right now. I mean, even John Kasich, who is the supposed moderate, is staunchly pro-life. You know, he's passed a whole bunch of anti-abortion legislation that he signed into law in Ohio over there. So that's, you know, the idea that you're going to have a Republican who is pro-choice on the issue of abortion is about as likely as having a Democratic candidate who is pro-life on the issue of abortion, and that's just not where the parties are. They've both moved in very different directions on those issues, on fiscal and social issues.
Lori in Kenosha, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment to the speaker that many of us nowadays, whether we're Republican or Democrat, we tend to see both of the parties not doing what they're supposed to do for us, the people. And instead of arguing with each other and putting each other down, you know, try to really work together and do what they're supposed to do for all of us instead of making a bickering situation between the two parties.
John, do a lot of people share those sentiments?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, most people are frustrated that things aren't getting done, whether you're, you know, I mean, you're a staunch conservative or a staunch liberal, you know, you haven't had a lot of movement in the last 4 years with divided government. There are places where they should be able to work together. You know, when they do pass things, it's the kind of stuff that, you know, doesn't get a lot of praise, you know, passing a highway bill or, you know, just keeping the government funded. It doesn't really make a lot of people happy one way or the other.
And thanks so much, Lori, for your call. Whatever happened to Ben Carson?
You know, he's faded. I don't know.
He sure has.
I don't know whether it was the terrorist attacks in Paris where, you know, Carson was just so shaky on foreign policy in these debates that the idea of him being commander-in-chief was probably his biggest liability. And once the issue of terrorism really came to the forefront, I think the people were like, well, you know, he's a really nice guy. He's a smart, you know, he's a neurosurgeon. He's charismatic. You know, we really like that he's an outsider. But, you know, at the end of the day, would we want somebody more like Ted Cruz, mm-hmm. Marco Rubio, who has Senate experience, mm-hmm. to deal with these foreign policy issues?
I think John, thanks so much. We're out of time. I forgot to look at the clock. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
John McCormack, senior writer at the Weekly Standard, a conservative weekly magazine and blog. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and to K.P. for his on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for listening, everybody.